number 17, and we're in chapter 17, and that is purely coincidence. Now, part of me wants to, I'm going to get into a little bit of multiple personalities here, but part of me wants to title chapter 17, Destruction of Ecclesiastical Babylon, meaning the end time world religion, and then chapter 18, Destruction of the Political Babylon. And there is a distinction between the two. At the same time, the more I read this, the more I think it's talking about the same event. But just keep in mind, there are two different aspects to Babylon.
So it's kind of like Judges and Chronicles discuss the same events, but with different emphasis?
Well, yeah, but even less than that, because don't forget the chapter breaks we put in hundreds of years later.
Sure.
So chapter 17 and 18, whereas Judges, whereas Chronicles and 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles were different books. This is the same portion of the same book that we randomly divided. But let's take a look at this. Remember, the Revelation 16 spoke about the seven bowls of God's wrath at Christ's return. Now we go back to what I would call, you know, we go back somewhere into the tribulation period. And some guys put this right at the halfway point of what we commonly call the tribulation period. By the way, the seven-year tribulation period is based on Daniel's 70th week, a week of 7 years of Daniel chapter 9, okay? Nowhere does it say those first 3.5 years are bad. The Antichrist during the first 3.5 years allows the Jews to perform animal sacrifices in the temple. When Jesus says that the tribulation comes, he locks it in with the abomination of desolation in this, standing in the holy place in the temple. When the book of Revelation talks about the 3.5 years, it all seems to be geared at the second half. So I really see, I call this the tribulation period, the 7-year tribulation period, just because everybody else does. But if I'm going to try to be as biblical as possible, I would say the last 3.5 years is the tribulation period.
Just break out on your own, Bill, and start a new one.
Well, actually, there's some mid-tribbers who don't like being called mid-tribbers because they have the same view as me on the tribulation, although they see Jesus rapturing before the tribulation starts, but they see the tribulation starting halfway through what is commonly called the tribulation period. That's why I always gear up for trying to figure out how it's possible to survive 3.5 years, not an entire 7. Although, you know, the state's probably going to get progressively more, do more persecution of Christians.
The mark of the beast doesn't happen until that 3.5 year,
yeah. And the Antichrist doesn't rule the world until 3.5 years and that type of thing. So keep in mind, this is going back to somewhere in the tribulation period. And we have the vision of the great harlot in verses 1 to 6. Some really interesting stuff here. Back in Hosea, chapter 1 and verse 2, it's real interesting that minor prophet, what he speaks about, Hosea chapter 1, verse 2. When the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land," that's Israel, "commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord." God told him to marry a prostitute who was going to be unfaithful to him, And then, thus, his life was going to be a prophecy. His marriage was going to be a prophecy. Hosea representing God, and his unfaithful wife representing Israel, who was unfaithful to the Lord. So keep in mind that a harlot is often used not just in the physical, literal sense, but also in a symbolic, spiritual sense of what is supposed to be a true church, but in actuality is a false church. The great harlot, spoken about in the first six verses. Let's take a look at the first four verses. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality." Some very strong language. The word for harlot is pornēs in the Greek, and it means a prostitute. We get our word pornography from it. This chapter deals with her judgment, and it states that this woman, this harlot, this prostitute, sits on many waters. And the kings of the earth commit immorality with her, and the world is drunk with her immorality. She resides, it says, in a wilderness. Now, she may claim to reside in paradise, but in actuality, she can offer us nothing. She offers the world a false religion, but which promises a paradise, but in actuality is nothing but a barren desert from a religious standpoint. It says that she sits on a scarlet beast, and that she is full of blasphemous names. The scarlet beast is full of blasphemous names. Or how exactly is that worded?
Sitting on a scarlet beast.
Yeah,
covered with blasphemy.
Okay. And the beast has seven heads and the ten horns. And the vision is explained in verses 7 to 18, so we're going to get to that. That's the only reason why I'm not breaking this stuff down right now. This passage interprets itself as it goes on. But this harlot is dressed in purple and scarlet with expensive jewelry. When you go back to Hosea chapter 2, the book of Hosea, minor prophet, which means it usually takes a little longer, fine. Hosea chapter 2 and verse 13. God says, "And I will punish her for the days of the Baals, when she used to offer sacrifices to them," the nation of Israel, worshiping a false Canaanite god, "and adorn herself with her earrings and jewelry, and follow her lover so that she forgot me, declares the Lord." So God talks about Israel as if she's dressed up like a harlot with real fancy jewelry, trying to attract her victims, if you will. And this is the same picture that is painted of this harlot. Now, this harlot here is not Israel. This harlot here is the end time false church that will come in the last days. She's dressed in purple and scarlet, wears expensive jewelry. Now, many of the reformers have identified the purple and scarlet and the expensive wealth with the Church of Rome, with the Roman Catholic Church, and the purple and scarlet garments for some of their different worshiping. I think the main emphasis here is the description of a harlot, okay? That is the main emphasis. Now, there might be some further application there. I want to say this. I think that the liberal Protestant church is in much, much worse shape right now than the Roman Catholic Church as a whole. I have much more in common with the Roman Catholic priest, as long as that Roman Catholic priest believes that Jesus is God, the second person of the Trinity, which all Catholics are supposed to believe, and believe that a person can only be saved through the sacrifice of Christ on the cross. Now, we would disagree about the sacraments and the filtering of God's grace through these sacraments, through human priests, human mediators, to get that grace to people. But we'd have a lot more agreement than a liberal Protestant preacher who doesn't believe Jesus is God, the second person of the Trinity, who doesn't believe that salvation comes only through Him, and who believes all religions lead to God. At the same time, those liberal Protestant churches do not have a one-world structure, so that they are automatically canceled out as candidates for the end-time one-world religion. Yeah, TBN wouldn't even be able. They wouldn't have a structure to have the hierarchy in place. But with Rome, you've got it all in place. Where if the liberal Protestant churches merged with Rome, which is something that some of them do want to do, you could very well. All you need is a bad pope to rule ex cathedra that we now worship this guy sitting in the temple and not Jesus. And the structure's already in place, and it just so happens to be headquartered in Rome. Okay? So so keep that in the back of your mind as we go through this study. There's a gold cup there that's filled with abominations, unclean things, and immorality. Some of the reformers even viewed this as a... By the way, most of the reformers were not expecting a literal Antichrist, but they believed the papacy, whatever pope was there, he was the Antichrist. And by the way, the vicar of Christ, the Latin word vicar means the representative of Christ, but it can also mean instead of Christ. Its equivalent is in Greek is the word anti. So Antichrist and vicar of Christ, in a certain sense, are synonymous. And so the reformers, of course, the Catholic Church means the vicar of Christ, the Pope, as the representative of Christ on earth. But Antichrist, anti could be used either way as well. But in the Bible, it's only meant one way. But the reformers also view the gold cup there, the practice of the Mass, trying to turn the bread and the wine into the body and blood of Christ, and this and that. I myself, I think that I disagree with the Catholic view there. But if you took a wooden literal interpretation of the Last Supper passages, that would be the interpretation. But I don't see if Jesus called himself the vine and we're the branches, and we don't take that literal, I don't see any reason why we should take it literal when he says, "This is my body," when obviously the guy holding that bread, his body wasn't broken yet, and so it was either symbolic on the Last Supper or symbolic now. You know, whatever the case, some have locked that in on that particular part. I think it's talking more about the that those who drink from the wine that she offers are going to drink in the abominations and the unclean things and the immorality of the end-time world religion. And by the way, even the present Catholic Pope, I don't know how... There are some leading Catholic theologians like Hans Krohn who denies infallibility, and he's gotten in a lot of trouble. He actually published a book against it, one of the leading Catholic theologians, and he goes through Catholic Church history and shows why popes shouldn't be considered infallible. And I don't know how many popes were named Pope Innocent that weren't real innocent. But and by the way, the Catholic historians admit that these guys did those things. But they say, but as ruthless as they were, some of them were murderers, some of them were adulterers. But whenever they spoke ex cathedra or called the church council, the Holy Spirit would intervene and prevent them from... A lot like we say about inspiration of the scriptures. At the same time, though, if Peter wasn't faithful to his wife, we'd have a heck of a time accepting that the Holy Spirit would choose to inspire him rather than choosing to inspire somebody else. So I think it does cause us to question it. And even the Catholic Pope, present Catholic Pope, Pope John Paul II, is warning that the present group of cardinals who will pick the next pope are more of the pro-abortion, pro-gay rights, who cares what you believe type of Catholics, which the Pope is totally opposed to. And he's even implied in some of his speeches that he would, that after he dies, the next pope is probably going to be a rotten one. And he even implied that he might die prematurely, because these guys are getting impatient. He's living a little longer than they expected.
Can you retire as pope, or are you pope until you die?
You're pope until you die, but there's been a lot of popes who've been booted out through military force, and another guy became pope, and different things like that. But that was way back in history. But you are supposed to be pope for life. And so there's even Pope John Paul I was only 30 days in office, and one of his big emphases was getting rid of the wealth of the church, and he dies 30 days, and then there was a report somebody gave him a glass of water in the middle of the night, and then there was speculation that he was poisoned, and then all of a sudden a few books came out on it, and then all of a sudden you never heard of it again. And there are even some ancient Catholic prophecies, which you could take it or leave it, because some Catholic saints are legitimate saints. Some Catholic saints, like Padre Pio, who my father respected a lot, I'm convinced the guy was demon-possessed. We could talk about him at length, probably won't, not in these lectures, but he just basically is getting the tar kicked out of him by demons in the middle of the night, so he's got blood everywhere. Then he got the stigmata, like St. Francis of Assisi, and I see no biblical justification for a man getting the wounds of Christ in his hands and his feet, to the point where Padre Pio was talking about how he's gonna take certain kind of suffering and punishment to give, to pay for the sins of other people, to give them less time in purgatory. That's seems to place himself, put himself in the place of Christ. And then he was supposedly on several occasions in two places at the same time, and just a whole lot of crazy stuff. But there were certain Catholic prophecies that the second to last pope would be a good pope, but he'd be murdered, assassinated, and it would be kept secret for a long time. And the last pope would be a very evil pope who would lead people astray, or the second to last. And the way the prophecy goes, it makes it sound like the last pope. It sounds like a description of Christ. But, you know, you could take that or leave it, just some speculation there. But the Reformers did view this end-time world church type of scenario as definitely being wrong. Now, the harlot's name is given as verse 5. And upon her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So the name is Babylon the Great. She's referred to as the mother of harlots, or the mother of prostitutes and abominations of the earth.
Why mystery? What's the meaning behind that?
We're going to talk a little bit about that. Not a real lot, but there has been a certain thing throughout history called the mystery religions. Some of the more modern types would be like the Gnostics, and a lot of the New Agers, and where there's like some higher mysterious type knowledge that only the initiated have, kind of like the Illuminati, the Masons, the Mormons.
I got one question. So where is Babylon referred to, the city of seven hells in Revelation? I know we're talking about that.
Yeah, later in this chapter.
Well,
yeah.
Where did it go to the
hand? Let's see, verses 9 to 11, somewhere in there. And we'll get to that later in this message and all, but in Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 1 and 2, says, Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abominations, and say, Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, Your origin and your birth are from the land of the Canaanite. Your father was an Amorite, and your mother a Hittite. And down at 15 to 17, it talks about, but you trusted in your beauty. So it's talking to Jerusalem. It's talking Jerusalem as the headquarters in Judah, and at one time of all Israel, you trusted in your beauty and played the harlot because of your fame, and you poured out your harlotries on every passerby who might be willing. Talks too a little bit further about wearing clothes of various colors, the beautiful jewels made of gold, and that type of thing. But just keep in mind, this is very, very common. Very, very common illustration of the harlot for false religion. Verse 32, you adulterous wife, you take strangers instead of your husband. And so this, you're supposed to be a true church, the true religion, worshiping the true God, having a relationship with the true God of the Bible. Instead, you're worshiping a bunch of false gods. Let me take this before I forget it. Over here. If I don't get it now, I'll forget. Okay, but keep that in mind. The harlot symbolizes here in this particular passage, apparently from the hints that are given, all organized apostate religious movements. All organized apostate religious movements from Nimrod to the end time worldwide apostate church. Let me repeat that. The harlot here seems to symbolize all organized apostate religious movements from Nimrod to the end time worldwide apostate church. Now keep in mind that 1 Timothy 4:1 tells us in the last days there will be doctrines of demons leading people astray. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 to 3 tells us that, and by the way, I think in 1 Timothy 4:1 it talks about too the falling away, the apostasy that will be occurring in those last days with the doctrines of demons. But the 1 Timothy 4:1, but the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith. The word, I think it's the word, if you want to check that out, John, in the Greek, I think it's the word for apostasy, which is almost the same word in the Greek. Falling away of the faith. So these are people who profess the system, their professors really to believe in the true God of the Bible. You can't fall away from something that you don't profess, at least profess. Some will fall away from the faith, paying attention. This doesn't teach that you can lose your salvation. But the falling away of the faith, they were paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. So you got in the last days a false church that claims to be the true church, headquartered, we're going to see that it's headquartered in Rome, and then claims to be the true church, but it's actually a church based on the doctrines of demons. Now let me say this about the current state of Catholicism. It still has the true gospel message. And there's a lot of guys that say, well, they have the true Jesus, but they say in the Council of Trent that they deny justification by faith. Yeah, but I can point to both Catholic scholars like Peter Kreeft and Protestant scholars like Alistair McGrath, who both admit that the Catholic Church defines justification and faith in James-type terms, in James's terminology, not Pauline terminology, which means in the end they're both saying the same thing but in different ways. Now the Catholics work it out through a highly complex system that is very problematic. But I think the main problem with Catholicism is the additions to the true faith that really, if you try to hold both, it just about cancels them out. So the true believers in Catholicism have to get through the jungle of false teachings to find the kernel of truth that is there. And then many of them feel led to leave Catholicism, as I did. But some still do stay, and there are some Catholics that I know with a vibrant love for the Lord. But
the verb is apostasy, by the way.
Okay. And in the end time, though, if Rome is this end time world church, there's going to have to be a removal of that any element of the truth that is there. because the Antichrist is going to be worshipped as God, not Jesus. A lot of the added things that have been added to Catholicism over the year, I would say some of those things I would call, some of them I would say aren't too harmful, but some of them are straight out doctrines of demons, I would say. Anytime you start saying that Mary had no sin at all, was without sin, she was conceived immaculately, I think that's very problematic. And then some of these visitations of Mary, though the Catholic Church has never ruled officially that they accept them, but the Pope himself does accept them, but he hasn't said it ex cathedra. You've got levitation that's occurred during some of these episodes, and the messages that are coming from them, from the supposed Mary, she's not the Mary, the mother of Jesus. I think the Bible talks about who she really is, and we'll get to that a little later in this message. But the harlot symbolizes all organized apostate religious movements from Nimrod to the end time worldwide apostate church. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 verses 1 and 3 also talks about before Christ comes to the church and gathers the church to him, the day of the Lord, the apostasy must occur first. So organized religion. There are still going to be thriving churches in the tribulation period, except there's going to be about 4 or 5 members to each one of them, and they're going to be living out in the woods, freezing, and wondering where their next meal's going to come from. But the organized, quote-unquote, Christian church is going to have apostatized by that point. By the way, this, in Germany, there was a big, huge Christian church, but they were Christian in name only, and they backed Hitler when he came to power, because all the true Christians were not in leadership, and were persecuted or whatever, but the church had apostatized from the faith to the point where one German theologian said there was no pastor or theology professor in all of Germany that he knew of that still held to the deity of Christ or the doctrine of the Trinity. But the harlotry here speaks not of physical adultery, but of spiritual adultery, unfaithfulness to God. Unfaithful, leaving the true spouse, the God of the Bible, for other false gods. Now let me give you a brief history of the harlot, the mystery, of the false religion. Take a look. By the way, I think there's different. Did anybody have an NIV?
Yeah.
Well, why don't you read verse 5? Verse 5 here, it's a mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abomination. How does that read there?
It's only one word different. Instead of harlots, it's mother of prostitutes.
But what does it say about the mystery there?
There's no article.
No, is it...
this title was written on her forehead. Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes, and the abomination of, and the abominations of the earth.
Yeah. Okay, see, that makes all the difference right there. Because, see, that's saying Mystery Babylon. That's part of her name, her title.
And they've got it locked off.
Yeah. See, look in the New American Standard. They inserted the indefinite article, which grammatically you can. So it's a mystery, and then the title is Babylon. See? There is no indefinite article in the Greek, so sometimes you insert it, sometimes we don't.
Well, there's a footnote here that says possibly not a part of the title.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a tough call. But it could be that mystery could be part of it, and again, it could be not. There is a lot of mystery within Catholicism, as well as many of the other, as many mystery cults. I'm not calling Catholicism a mystery cult, but does anybody know where we get the word hocus pocus from? Those are the words in Latin that the priest speaks when supposedly the wine and the bread is changing into the blood and the body of Christ. So that right there is where we get the hocus pocus from. So there's been a lot of mystery, a lot of mysteries and unexplainable things that you're supposed to just believe on faith within the system of Catholicism, which a lot of it they got from a lot of the mystery religions. So if the NIV interpreted it right, if mystery is part of the title, mystery is a big aspect of it. If the New American Standard is right, if it's just a mystery, about this Babylon system, then John's explaining the mystery to us.
Well, the footnote goes on to say that basically if they had decided to go that route, they would have translated it as this mysterious title was written on her forehead. They would have made it an ad.
Yeah. Then it would have been like this, yeah. So mystery could be part of the system, or it just could be a mystery about the system. And either way would make sense. Take a look, a brief history of the harlot, the mystery of the false religion, or the history. It's either the history of the mystery of false religion, or it's the history of the false religion of mystery. You see what I'm getting at? The mysteries are either in the system or just about the system. But either way, it would be true to say it either way. In Genesis chapter 10, verses 8 to 12, it says, "Now Cush became the father of Nimrod." Now when you look at Cush, he was the son of Ham, so that made him the grandson of Noah. So the great-grandson of Noah was a guy named Nimrod. It says, "He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel." And so that was the start of Babylon. This guy was the first king there. "And Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar." Shinar is where the Tower of Babel was built. Why did I take it to verse 12? Oh, it says, he said, "From that land he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh." So he built Nineveh. A couple other cities. But he's also famous. So he's famous for the building, basically, of two cities. One where he's the king of Babylon, another one Nineveh, which later on became the heads of Nineveh, the Assyrian Empire, and Babylon, the later Babylonian Empire. So this was the old Chaldean Empire, the old Babylonian Empire, long before the Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar came to rise to power much later. In Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 to 9, you have the whole earth speaking the same language and building this tower, trying to reach the heavens with this tower. In Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 to 9, the Tower of Babel. They spoke the same language. They wanted to make a name for themselves. A lot of speculation about it. Some ancient writers recorded that the same ingredients that went into the tower, the tar and stuff like that, also went into the ark. So it sounded like they were trying to make a waterproof tower so high that if God flooded the earth again, they could still survive.
Well, that's implied by the statement that we should never be overtaken by flood again.
Yeah, and so what that would imply there then is that they just rejected God's promise not to flood the earth again. Like, rather than have a enter into a covenant with you, we're just going to build our own protection, our own security, so we can do whatever we please, no matter how wicked we get, if you flood the earth again. Well, that's some speculation. Leave Josephus. Had that speculation, lived from 30s, the Jewish historian, from 37 to 97 AD, Jewish Pharisee. Also, what we're finding with these ziggurats in the land I believe it's Iraq right now, where Babel was, these ancient ones, we're finding a lot of them, because of the insignias on them, they seem to be dedicated to pagan deities and the worship of the stars as gods. So it may have been, that's a second possibility why God might have been taken off. It might have been for the worship of false gods. But whatever the case, man was trying to make a big name for himself. Man was in love with himself because of his technology and all these advances. God says in Genesis 11, one of the reasons why we have to go down there, he says to the other members of the Trinity, and change their speech so they divide their languages so that man multiplies over the earth like they were supposed to do in the first place, rather than being one united thing. One of the reasons why we got to do it is because now nothing will be impossible for them to do. Now, it's not that God is worried about competition. That's obviously a hyperbole. He's making an exaggeration. There will still be some things impossible for man to do, But man's technology would increase so much that man is basically going to wipe himself. Mankind united in rebellion against God. This is a lesson that was needed during the Tower of Babel. It's a message that's needed now, especially with this thrust towards a one-world government and a one-world religion. Mankind united while still in rebellion against God will only do two things. One, increase technology, and two, because of it, because it's the technology that's not submitted to God in His ways, it will just usher in the annihilation, the total devastation of all life as we know it on this planet. The only thing that's going to interrupt that process is the second coming of Christ. God has to interrupt. At certain times, mankind gets so united in his rebellion, his wickedness and rebellion against God, that God has to intervene. Did it one time with a flood, did it another time with the Tower of Babel, and the next time he intervenes, he's going to do it with the second coming of Christ. But America has been the melting pot of a lot of nations, and we've taken technology. Now we've got this big push towards a one-world government. Just look at what America did. 1903, the Wright brothers come over here, and for the first time in the history of mankind, we put in the air something heavier than air, and we get to stay in the air for a reasonable amount, for a decent amount of time. 66 years later, we put a man on the moon. That's the kind of geometric advances that technology can make when you combine the greatest minds from around the world. So now everybody wants to speak the same language and stuff. We're getting technology where we're trying to get phones where you can speak to somebody in a foreign nation, and from the amount of time that it takes for him to say the words and you to hear it, it's already been translated for you mechanically. Yeah.
The United Nations has already developed an international language.
They're working on it. So then there's more. I think the United Nations, too, is going to be you got the one world church. Well, one thing they're starting to realize, they always want to fight religion. These one worlders always want to fight religion. Well, they're finding out religion is stronger than them. So what they're finding out, what they need is not only a one world government, but it's got to be a one world government in cahoots with a one world religion. Hence Revelation 17. But anyway, God scatters man because this technology is advancing. But you know, there's so many people that tell us the answer to all our problems today is just if we had a one world government, we'd live happily ever after. And they don't realize that all we're going to do is increase technology, and without submitting to God, we're going to use that technology more for evil than for good. And, you know, with all the increased technology and medical advances and stuff, you'd think we'd live longer. We're really not living hardly any longer. And I think the main reason is because all the chemicals we're putting in food now. Whereas maybe we'd be living
in the air.
And the air and the water. With all the advances we made, we'd probably be living to be 100. But because we got to stick all these chemicals to try to make God's apples better, you know, we're still dying 70, 75. And then you get, I think the average male dies at about age 73 right now in America if he's married. If he's single, his life expectancy is about 57 years. Reason why, what's the average single male in America doing? Is he celibate? He ain't celibate. He's messing around with different women. And so that's going to take a good 16 years of his life. Now, if he decides to mess around with men, they find his life expectancy is cut from 57 down to 42 years. And if he gets, and that's a homosexual without AIDS. Homosexual gets AIDS, then it's cut down to 39 years. So, you know, AIDS, everybody's acting like AIDS is so devastating in the homosexual community. It only takes 3 years away, because even without AIDS, the homosexuals will still be killing themselves off. Just a horrible lifestyle. But that's the way man is when he unites in his rebellion against God. Now, keep in mind, Genesis 11, you compare the genealogies, and then you try to place this, because there's a guy, I think Peleg, that the world was divided during his life, and you check out where he was. Most scholars agree, and based on this, plus ancient historical traditions passed down to us in writing, outside the Bible, that lists Nimrod as the king of Babylon when the tower was built. These ancient legends also tell us that Nimrod's wife was Semiramis, and she was the high priestess of an idolatrous cult. So you got Nimrod. This is all, by the way, a lot of this information is in Walvoord's book. He did a great job on that. Nimrod's wife, he was the king. His wife was Semiramis. She was the high priestess of his cult. And she had a little son named Tammuz, who was a false messiah. And it was his claim to be conceived miraculously. So if you will, he was a satanic prefiguring of Christ, an antitype of Christ. Tammuz was the son, obviously, of Semiramis and Nimrod. Tammuz claimed to be the savior. He was supposedly killed by a wild beast, and then legend states that he was supposedly brought back to life. Now, probably 90% of this stuff is just all faked or whatever, just legend. But he was supposedly brought back to life, but you have like a false resurrection, a false incarnation. But anyway, this is the first that we have in ancient history, the first reference to mother-child worship. Then we have this mother-child, the worship of Mother Semiramis and her child Tammuz. That mother-child worship began to spread from culture to culture. In Babylon, it was Nimrod was the father, but the wife was Semiramis, and the son was Tammuz. In Egypt, Isis was the mother, and Osiris was the son. In Canaan, the mother was Ashtaroth and Baal. Actually, some of these, though, it's so hard to figure out that some of them might have been just a male deity and a female deity, and it's hard to figure out if it's a mother-son or a father or a husband-wife type thing. In the Greek Empire, it was Aphrodite and her son Eros. The Roman Empire changed their names to Venus and Cupid. We're all familiar with the naked little baby Cupid with the bow and arrow. But paganism eventually crept its way in. Remember, the main difference between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism, the Protestantism, at least conservative Orthodox Protestantism, says the authority we stand on is the Bible alone. The Bible is the final authority for faith and practice, for how we should live a life and what we should believe. The Catholic Church says that the final authority we stand on is the Bible plus church tradition. Well, once they said the Bible plus church tradition, i.e. coming from the popes and the cardinals and their decisions, you open up the door for the human element. And little by little, for the last 1,500 years, paganistic ideas have been creeping into the church. And so this Venus and Cupid that dates back to Semiramis and Tammuz, the female, the mother-child worship, eventually came into play with Mary and Jesus. The Catholic Church draws a distinction. The Catholic theologians draw a distinction between the worship of Mary or the worship of the saints and veneration of them. The Catholic Church has ruled it is wrong to worship Mary. It is wrong to worship the saints. They are to be venerated. In other words, they are to be respected to such a high degree that you just barely stop short of worship. And you only worship God. However, the average layperson, whether he's Catholic or Protestant, cannot split theological hairs like that. So even though the Catholic Church looks at the way the Catholic Church in Central America worships Mary, and the Catholic Church, Vatican II, titled that study The Cult of Mary, even they saw it was wrong, you just don't have the lay people being able to draw the line. So you do have a lot of lay people who are Catholics who are worshiping their favorite saints. But I'll tell you, you got some Protestants out there, some professing Christians, that their God, they can tell me up and down, my God is Jesus, I worship Jesus. Let me tell you, if you're watching TV 40 hours a week, your God is not Jesus, unless you're reading the Bible 50 hours a week. And chances are, your God is whatever you give the most of your time to. But I'll tell you, you know, when you're working hard and with your family, whatever, if that is what God is leading you to do, you are worshiping Jesus and glorifying God in all that you do. But anyway, but in Roman Catholicism, it crept in. In fact, there was a time when the Roman Catholic Church was at the edge of a sword, was forcing pagans to join the Catholic Church, and they didn't even speak these people's language, and they kept the Mass in Latin, and the scriptures were still in Latin, so the people brought with them their pagan religions and just exchanged their false gods for Catholic saints. They saw the statues, they used to worship idols, they worshiped the statues. So although it was never taught by the Catholic Church, this is what you do, this is what crept into the church. And the problem came when little Johnny worships Mary because his grandma worships Mary, and now little Johnny becomes a priest, and now he's leading his whole parish astray when the Catholic Church is teaching you're not supposed to worship Mary. But Mary and the worship of Mary and Jesus, I believe, is part of that trend there. And so the Babylonian false religion worshipped this female deity, this female, this false goddess. So the paganistic female element entered into false religions in Babylon. Now, the liberal Protestant church right now is trying to reconcile with the Roman Catholic Church, despite the fact that much paganism has crept into the Catholic Church. We've got some passages I wanted to look at. I think all we're going to get through today is Revelation 17. So we might end up still getting that 24 lectures instead of 22. But I do want to spend a little bit of time on this. The Bible talks about the Queen of Heaven, which is one of the titles of Mary for the Catholics give her. And we're going to take a look at that and some of the verses there.